Jim Carrey. I didn't even have to say anything. I'm an addict. My name is Bobby.
Hey, Bobby.
It's great to be here. I was here last year, and it was wonderful, and I'm really glad I'm back. I forgot I was doing this. Susan asked me to do this morning, and I'm jet lagged, so I keep forgetting things. I have a unique relationship with this main speaker today. I'm the only person in this room that smoked crack with her. I know that for a fact. We met a long time ago, and we fell in love, and even the horrors of addiction and getting us clean and changing into different people and then different people and then different terror people have not managed to separate us. That's because she's so amazing. She's the queen of my night. She's a wonderful person. She's the most enthusiastic member of Narcotics Anonymous that I've ever met, which drives me crazy on a daily basis. So with that, I would like to introduce the love of my life, Susan.
Good morning. My name is Susan. I'm an addict from the Bronx. James, can you hear me in the back?
I can.
Okay. What an honor to be invited to any Narcotics Anonymous meeting or function or group is always an honor and a privilege, and it doesn't escape me how lucky and blessed I am to be in this process. I'm not saying this to impress you, but it impresses me. April 28th, 1988. And it took a long time for me to get there, to find the rooms. I had never heard of Narcotics. What do you first say? I'm a passionate member of Narcotics Anonymous. And I'm still passionate, and I'm still excited, and I still look forward to every meeting and event I go to. And I don't say, oh, God, another meeting tonight. I say, yes, I'm going to go see my friends. I'm going to get what I need. And if I'm lucky, I'll be able to give it away to somebody. Because that, for me, is the blessing, that I can share what I have. And I learned early on, it's not about me telling you what you need to do, telling you what you have to do, telling you what the program suggests you do. It's about telling you what worked for me, situation that I went through that maybe you're going through at the time, and that I was able to come out at the other end clean. And, it's funny because I'm going to back up in a minute, but my daughter was born 30 days before I got clean. And that's not something I'm proud of. It took till I was almost 9 months clean to find Narcotics Anonymous, to find a new way of life, to know a place that I belong, to feel like I was part of, and to get on this journey. And she has given me a lot of my best wisdom over the years, and I completely lost my train of thought. I was going to say something about my daughter, and I don't know. I'll get to that anyway. So, I grew up in a Jewish home, working class home. When my mother found out I was an addict, she told me I was the only Jewish addict in the world. And guys, I believed her. I didn't know any other Jewish girls who were nice Jewish girls, who were like running the streets of Hell's Kitchen, who were using throughout the night, who were begging for money, who were stealing, who were conniving, who were slick and quick and whatever, and pregnant and homeless by choice. I did not know any other Jewish girls in that situation. I didn't know anyone who ever got clean. I never heard of Narcotics Anonymous, as I said. I heard of the other fellowship, and I was sure I didn't belong there. I did not know that a drug was a drug is a drug. And back in 1988, if you wanted to get into treatment, the only way was if you were an alcoholic. There was no treatment for us. There were no options for, at least for women, and particularly for pregnant women. And when my family discovered the mess I was, my sister, who lived in Hong Kong at the time, flew into New York to try and save her sister. And she made appointments at treatment centers for me, and she would come and meet me, and my father would get on a bus and come and get, you know, take me to the welfare center, and he'd stand online, my like 80-year-old father, while I sat my pregnant butt in his seat. You know, I'm not proud of any of that. And all the appointments that she made for me, I never met their criteria. There was one where she told me I had to call them every day, and back then, this is really dating myself, pay phones, I think they were a quarter. Could have been a dime, but I think they were a quarter then. And I had to save that 25 cents every day to make that call, and I did, because I was terrified what was going to happen. It was, you know, I had never wanted to be a parent. I had never planned on being a parent. I had never gotten pregnant, regardless of all the risks I had taken. But this time, I had met a man in a bar. I met the bartender. And he was doing the scratch-offs, and I kept winning free drinks. And he said, give me a minute. And he walked down to the other end of the bar, found this skinny red-headed bartender, and said to him, I've just met the woman of your dreams. He didn't know I was the woman of his nightmares. And that's how I left my first marriage, because I didn't know that I could just get a divorce. It was terrible. It was miserable. It was all about only drugs and fights and everything else. And I didn't know I could leave him. No one in my family had ever gotten divorced. And so I met this bartender. I don't know how to give advice on beginnings of relationships. I can't tell you. You meet a woman, you ask her out, you go to dinner, you bring her flowers, you maybe meet the parents. All I can tell you is my experience, right? I can only share what I have. You meet a man in a bar, you have sex in the backseat of a cab, and you move in together a week later. 40 years ago. So I tell my sponsees all the time, I can't give a relationship. I can tell you about middles, but not beginnings. I'm running the streets of Manhattan, I'm begging for money, my family, I was MIA in their lives, and they didn't know what to do, and they were terrified, and my parents found another fellowship for people, family members of recovering addicts, of addicts, and they taught them not to enable me. My father used to let me come home, whether it was 2-3 o'clock in the morning, it didn't matter. He'd sit me down at the kitchen table, he'd make me homemade pancakes, he'd slip me a 20 on the way out the door. And now when I wanted to come home and find a place to sleep, my mother said, we got your referral to a shelter. I said, a shelter? I'd rather sleep on the train. Like, my thinking was really convoluted, and that's what I did. I slept on the train. And I said, what is this enabling thing? Like, what do you... Yeah. That's what they were taught, and that's what I needed. I needed to have the door shut on me. So fast forward, I'm coming up on my 9th month of pregnancy. I did not know it. I had stayed in a residential hotel that the city put me into, because like I said, my dad had helped me get on welfare. And I'm walking to the train station. So I don't know where I was headed, but I was walking. They gave me a token. You guys remember tokens? Train tokens. In New York, it was tokens. And I was in the subways all the time begging for tokens, because you could, it's not like a Metro card. No one's giving you their Metro card. But they were giving me their tokens, and I was adding them up at the end of the day, and I might have made $25 or $50 or $75, and I would cop. And I thought I was better than working people. Like, I was judging everyone who was a suit and tie at 7, 8 o'clock in the morning on their way to work, because I had all this money for a few minutes. So I don't know where I was headed, but I know that I was miserable. It was early April 1988. The sun was beaming down on me. The walk to the station felt like it was 10 miles. It was probably a mile and a half. And there was a payphone at the station. And I had met a man like 4 or 5 days before that on the streets of Manhattan when I was begging for money. I had stopped his car at a red light. There were 5 cars, and I picked that car. I don't know why I picked that car. My high power... God incidents, because I don't believe in coincidences. And I walked up to him, and I told him I was pregnant, and I was hungry. Could he help me get something to eat? And he looked at me like, yeah, you're pregnant. And I opened my jacket, and I patted my belly, and I said, this is all me. and he took me for a meal. And for some reason, for the first time in my life, I admitted I had a problem with drugs. I didn't know I was an addict. I didn't call myself an addict. I never heard of Narcotics Anonymous, like I said. And I told him I needed help, and he told me if I was willing to relocate, you know, to get clean, like his girlfriend lived down south, and she could take me in and all this other stuff, and, you know, he would help me. Just a good Samaritan. No agenda. So that day, walking to the train station, I got that quarter and I made that call to him. And he told me, get on the train, come to Queens and stay with him. Which I did, because I didn't know where else to go. And when I got there, he told me I could stay as long as I wanted, but if I left, I couldn't come back. So I stayed. And his roommate came home that night. I was sitting at his kitchen table, eating his homemade meatloaf with my feet up, and he looked at me and he goes, who are you? And I'm like, I'm Susan, I live here now. So his roommate knew better. He knew the damage I could do. He knew how dangerous it was, that he was picturing his microwave on someone's shoulder going down Delancey Street. And he was trying to get rid of me. So he went through my papers, and he found my parents' name, and he called them, and he said that, you know, they had to come and get me. And my mother said, she's your problem now. Enabling, she learned. And we called him Jewish Boy with Telephone. And he started getting on the phone and to find a place where he could unload me. And he found a private shelter in the Bronx. I grew up in Brooklyn. I had used in the Bronx a few times because we had family there. But I would never really been to the Bronx, knew nothing about it. And this shelter did not accept pregnant women. They did not accept babies. They did not accept addicts. And he convinced them to interview me. And they actually allowed me to come in 30 days before my daughter was born. And I had already been taken to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting by his roommate. And when I had walked in there, people were hugging me and loving me and giving me, like, encouragement. And I didn't feel huggable. I felt despicable and dirty and ashamed. I mean, because I knew better. Like, here I am pregnant trying to stop, and I knew better. And I couldn't stop. And I knew better. I mean, I had a college education. It didn't mean anything. I just couldn't stop. And when he took me to that first Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and I heard people sharing, like, honest, authentic stuff, I was shocked. So this one woman was sharing, and I can't believe I remember this from almost 38 years ago. She was sharing how she had put herself at risk all the years using, and that she had gone and taken an HIV test, and that she was going to come back. Had to go back the next day to get the results, and she was going to come back to the meeting the next week and share with us. And I thought, oh my God, these people are so courageous. I couldn't tell you on a one-on-one basis the stuff in my life. And she's talking in front of 50 people sharing something so intimate. And my interest was piqued. So he wound up getting me into this private shelter in the Bronx. And I knew I had to go to meetings. And I started going to meetings in the Bronx. And the first meeting I went to was called the Back to Life Group of Narcotics Anonymous. It's the oldest NA meeting in New York City. It became my home group. When I saw the sign on the door that said Back to Life, I'm like, is it possible? Could I really come back to life? I didn't imagine it could be possible. And it's funny because during my addiction, I really wasn't doing any reading, and I had been a voracious reader for years, but this one poem kind of always resonated in my head. And I never knew why until years later, and it was just a short thing. It said, first you just do it, then you do it for fun, then you do it seriously, then you're done. I was done a long time before I stopped. You know, I had been in a violent marriage, and I would not call myself a victim. I was a willing volunteer. If I didn't come home with drugs, he was pissed. So I remember one night throwing the keys at his head. Thankfully, I have a bad aim. I missed him. And like I said, the way I left him was by moving in with Bobby. And I started making meetings, and it was breaking my heart because the love of my life, my soulmate, he was not ready to stop. And he always showed up for me and Tara. Oh, my daughter, she was born when I was clean 30 days, and such a miracle. I named her Tara Miracle. And I thought she was the miracle that got me. She was the miracle that got me clean. But I learned real early on that I had to stay clean for me. And at first I really didn't. I stayed clean for her. So I came home from the hospital. For some reason they made a mistake and they let me out even though she had cocaine residue in her blood. And they called me up 3 days later and said if I wanted to keep the baby I had to get in a program or they would remove her. So I got on the phone and I found a program that required the least amount of me. It was an acupuncture clinic in the South Bronx. They had a little tiny room in the basement where they had Narcotics Anonymous meetings. And like I walked into that little tiny room and I felt at home. And I started getting a support group there. And I don't understand this, how it happened, but I stopped lying and I stopped cheating. And I, for the most part, stopped manipulating. For the most part. And I started getting connected. And I felt at home. And I felt the love. And I would go there with Tara. And every time they did a urine on me, it was clean. I don't know how it happened. Because I didn't know I was ready. But the hell, you know, Narcotics Anonymous opened up the gates of hell to let me out. And I know what hell is, and I never want to go back. So I was learned that I had to follow suggestions. And I was taught that I had to make a meeting a day. I made 90 meetings in 90 days. And I thought, like I said, I stopped manipulating for the most part. I thought that I could make a meeting today, skip tomorrow, make two the next day. And someone said, when you use it, you skip days. And I never skipped even hours. Even when I was sleeping, I was conniving. Because we were staying in a residential hotel at that time, Bobby and I, towards the end of my addiction, before I wound up homeless again. And I would be waiting for the footsteps coming down the hall for someone who wanted me to cop for them or cook for them. I thought I was Chef Boyardee. And so I was always manipulating. So I learned that I had to embrace the principles of this program. And I was told I needed to get a sponsor. And I went to the Back to Life group of Narcotics Anonymous one Friday night. And at that time, we met 4 times a week. And it was a smoke-filled room. And here I have a newborn baby. But I knew that if I didn't have Narcotics Anonymous, I wouldn't have her. So I had no choice. And then they started smoking on one side of the room. And the smoke always went to the other side anyway. And I remember I was sitting in the front and I was nursing her. And a woman came up to me and said, you can't do that in the front. And it was very discreet. Nobody could see anything. She goes, you're distracting the men. I said, you know, I need to be here in the front to hear the message. It was amazing that I spoke up for myself. And I raised my hand that night, and I said I was new, I was scared, I didn't know how to do this. I was told I needed a sponsor, and a woman came up to me. It was before cell phones, guys. And she gave me a piece of paper with her name on it, and she wrote, call me. And I went back to the shelter that night, and I told the night manager I needed to make a call. And he said, it's past calling hours, and I felt like saying, you don't know who I am. But I said, no, I need to do this in order to stay clean. And he let me call her. And I asked her if she would sponsor me. And she said, I'll be your temporary sponsor. She temporarily sponsored me for 10 and a half years in recovery. So I got to tell you guys, I don't know how to do anything temporarily in Narcotics Anonymous. I know how to make the same meetings, sit basically in the same chair. That means I have to come early. Because if I don't come early, someone else might be sitting in my seat and I'm going to get a resentment. So I learned how to be consistent and get involved and give service, and I got involved in H&I real early, and I learned that people who give service and get involved in H&I and work the steps, especially as you get up to the fourth step, it's not as terrifying as using. And I learned from people who didn't follow those suggestions, the people who don't do that stuff usually pick up. And a friend of mine who I was going to meetings with, he relapsed. And when I asked him what had happened, he said he was afraid to do his fourth step. And so I decided that what I learned is that people who work four steps very rarely relapse. Honest and thorough four steps. Which terrified me, but I knew, like I said, going back out was even more scary for me. So I started using my sponsor, and I'm living in a shelter, and Bobby's still using, and every time he wanted to see the baby, I had to make sure he wasn't drinking, there was no alcohol on his breath, and he was giving us money for Tara, but I couldn't let go. And he kept he didn't relapse because he never got clean. And my sponsor told me let go or be dragged. And I was also told if you go to sit in a barbershop long enough, you're going to get a haircut. All that stuff. Do you guys hear that anymore?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was told to chase my recovery as hard as I chased the drugs. And Bobby said that every sentence I talked to him about had at least five slogans in it. It probably did. So I was told to let go of him. And that was the most painful thing I could ever do. Because I was in love with him. But he was a hot mess. And I knew it was dangerous for me and for Tara. And so I'm living in this shelter, and the city of New York, in its grace, found me an apartment when I was clean, probably about 9 months, coming up on a year, in the South Bronx. And it was a very nice apartment in a quiet building in a terrible neighborhood, very active. But the first person I met when I went to the corner to make a call in that luncheon on the corner was another recovering addict who I'd met in the rooms, and she lived in that building. And I was embraced and loved in the South Bronx. I was the only white girl for a couple of miles. It didn't matter. The meetings I went to were very diverse. That didn't matter. I got involved in the fellowship there. I was given love there. I was given support there. I was, you know, my parents never raised us with prejudice. And when I was coming up on a year, and I was going to celebrate in the South Bronx in a meeting, here I'm thinking, oh my God, are my parents going to be comfortable? Because I knew they were going to come to the anniversary. Are they going to be comfortable here? We look different from everyone else. My parents were thrilled. They were thrilled. They were getting their daughter back. They didn't know if it was going to stick and stay, but they felt like they were too old to care for Tara and that this was the only shot. Like I said, they were in their 80s already. And my father had his daughter back for 20 years and my mother for 28, which beyond expectations. So I'm working steps, and I'm doing service, I'm involved in H&I, and I'm trying to let go of Bobby, and I'm living in this apartment in the South Bronx, and I'm making meetings every day, and somebody would always walk us home or drive us home, even though it was only a few blocks, because they knew it wasn't safe for me. And one day Bobby came to me, he said he wanted help. Without me dragging him, without me pushing him, without me forcing him, without me sicking the man on him, which I did, without me putting literature under his pillow, which I did, locking him out whenever he smelled of alcohol, all that stuff I did, nothing worked because you know what happens. We get clean when we're ready. So he needed help. He wanted help. He was ready for help. He wanted to go into detox. Made a few calls, connected him with another recovering addict who had some connections in the recovery field, and he got into a detox. And he came out and he stayed clean. And that was 34 years ago. And I drove him crazy. Because I watched him every second. If we went to a meeting, I'm not paying attention to the speaker, I'm watching him. Is he paying attention? Is he nodding his head? Did he find a sponsor? Is he working steps? And again, my sponsor had to tell me I had to be there for me. And she even told me that, you may need to make separate meetings. So here I'm making meetings, and Tara's getting a little older, and she's growing up in the rooms, and everyone called me Susan with the baby. And she's starting to talk, and we're in a meeting, and we make the circle, and she must have been about two, and before the Serenity Prayer started, you hear a little voice go, God! She knew the Serenity Prayer. We went to a meeting around that time, and there was a newcomer sitting next to us that raised his hand and said he had like a few days back, and Tara said, keep coming back. Went to my home group one night. The room was closed. It had been a flood. There was a sign on the door. I guess Tara was maybe three or four at that time, and probably four, and she said, what are we going to do, Mom? I said, we'll go home and watch some TV. She goes, Mommy, when you need a meeting, you go to a meeting. So I got my best wisdom from her. So, of course, I had a meeting list, and we made another meeting. I lived in the South Bronx with Bobby for about a year or two. And I always wanted to live in the neighborhood where my home group was, back to life. I felt comfortable. I felt comfortable everywhere, But what was weird was that for years when I was using, you wouldn't scare me, you couldn't upset me. I never cried because I didn't care about myself. I didn't know that. I didn't know I was on a death mission. I didn't know that nothing scared me because I wasn't afraid to die. So here I get clean and we go to these meetings and this program in the South Bronx, and I'm like holding my daughter and like looking around and scared. Like I started feeling, I got a TV set, but a little tiny TV set, and they had the commercial out for, I think it was Bell Telephone, said reach out and touch someone, and the grandfather's talking to his granddaughter on the other end of the, I'm crying. I'm sobbing. I'm like, what are these? Like, I began laughing and crying and developing an amazing support group. And before I even got into that apartment, and I'm still in the shelter, it was clean about 9 months, and my sponsor was going on vacation. And she came to me and asked me if she could give me the keys to her apartment so I could water her plants and take care of her pets. And I didn't have keys to my own apartment. I couldn't believe, I thought, if she trusts me, maybe I'm trustworthy. But I would listen to see if anyone else knew or shared any of the stuff that I told her. And it never happened. So I learned to trust in Narcotics Anonymous. And I learned to give service. And I learned to always have a newcomer in my life. And when I was clean a few years, I started sponsoring women. And I was going to meetings at this acupuncture clinic, and this one woman made a year there. And she came up to me and asked me if I'd speak at her anniversary. And I was so honored. I said, of course. So I show up at her anniversary, and she had gotten a little carried away. She came up to me. I asked 10 people to speak. She goes, would you mind just listening? I said, of course. Well, at the end of the meeting, there was a few minutes left, and she called me up to share. She said, I only had a few minutes, so I talked about what was closest to my heart was H&I, hospitals and institutions, giving service and bringing the message to addicts who couldn't hear it otherwise. And after the meeting, a guy came up to me. He was from a treatment center. It was actually a methadone program. And he asked me how they got, how can they get a Narcotics Anonymous meeting in their facility. And I got him in touch with the right people. And as I'm talking to him, so now, mind you, Tara's now coming up on 3 years old. She's like 2 years and 9 months. I didn't have to carry the baby bag and the carriage and the diapers and the bottles and all that stuff anymore. And my aspiration, because I had great aspirations, was to be a beach bum that summer. I wanted to do what you guys did. I wanted to take her with me. I didn't have to carry her and spend our summers hanging out on the beach. And somehow the words came out of my mouth. Are there any jobs available? And I like looked around, who said that? And he said, actually, there are. Because I had a college degree to put on my resume. No experience. And his boss called me the next day and called me in for an interview. And I disclosed that I was in recovery. I guess I was coming up on 3 years clean. And she looked at my resume, and we talked, and she offered me a job. She said, but this was Thursday. She goes, you need to start next Thursday, because that's when our training series starts. So Tara, as I said, was 2 years and 9 months. A lot of moms may know that at 2 years and 9 months is the time for certain vaccinations. So being an anal overplanning compulsive addict, I had already made that appointment months ago. Her appointment for the doctor for her physical was the next day. It was that Friday. She needed to have that in order to go into daycare. He said, you know, she's going to have the vaccinations before you come in. And then, you know, oh, I skipped it. I had to find a daycare center now that would take her within a week. So I walked around the corner from where we lived in the South Bronx. And I told the director I needed a spot for my daughter. He goes, that's okay. I'll put you on the waiting list. And again, I wanted to say, you don't know who I am. But what I said was, I really need this spot. I got offered a job. I'm on welfare for the first time in my life. This is my dream job, and I need to have. I start it next Thursday. And he's like, okay, we'll get you in. So Friday was the physical. I had to wean her off me for 3 days at the daycare. So the first day I had to be there 2 hours, the next day 1 hour, the next day half hour. Thursday I started the job. You might call it a coincidence. To me, it was a God incident. And because of that job, we were able to, at some point, afford to move into our own apartment without the city's help, without Section 8. And we went to look for, like I said, an apartment in the neighborhood where my home group was. And at that point, my parents were in our lives. They were crazy about Tara. My mother had said to me, around that time, I'm so proud of the mom you've become. My mother was the most critical person I've ever met. For her to say that to me, I can't express what it felt like. It must be true, because my self-esteem was below the ground. So my parents are in our lives. We go to see them very frequently with Tara, and whenever I went to Brooklyn, and Bobby's clean now. Whenever I went to Brooklyn, I'd make him Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And I went into this one NA meeting, and I met a woman who was my best friend's cousin growing up, and she remembered me. And I told her how I was homeless and I was looking for an apartment in the Bronx. And she goes, my father's partner, he's renting an apartment in Morris Park. I said, that's where I wanted to live, Morris Park. I said, but I really wanted a private house. It's a private house. But I actually needed a 3-bedroom because I take over. By this time, I was a shopping bag lady when I got clean. You can only imagine how much stuff I've accumulated since then, being an over-planner, over-shopper, over-everything. We needed an extra bedroom so Bobby could have his stuff because I was taking over. She goes, it's 3 bedrooms. I said, I was hoping for a backyard. She goes, it has a backyard. So we called. She said, he's only renting through word of mouth. So I called him. We had an appointment. We went to see the apartment. It was a really nice apartment, but when we went in the bathroom, the mirrors opened up like that. I'm like, I can see the back of my head. This is our apartment. Talk about vanity, right? 10 years later, we wound up buying that house, and we just last year, almost 2 years ago, I paid it off. Those are just the perks of recovery. That's not promise, but that's some of the blessings that's happened for me. So we moved into that apartment, and I wanted to start doing things I had done when I used, but without drugs. And one of the things I loved doing was going camping. So I started taking Tara to Narcotics Anonymous campouts. Bobby was not interested. He said, camping is like a hotel without room service. But he was willing to buy me a tent, and buy me a sleeping bag, and buy me an air mattress, and we squished everything we could possibly squish into my first car, which was a Mazda 626, which was not large. I would need 4 of those today to go camping. But And we went to our first Narcotics Anonymous camp out, and I had no idea how to put up the tent, and a woman was walking past with her husband, and she goes, "You help those women." Put up our tent, and we loved it. Now, I had taken Tara to her first camp out when she was 2 years old, because the man who saved my life, whose apartment I got clean in, he used to go to what was called Rainbow Gatherings. And that's like a bunch of hippies who get together on land that's like government-owned or in the middle of nowhere. You have to hike into it with a backpack on your back, and they would live off the land, and they would have a communal kitchen and do all the cooking. And of course, everyone's passing joints back and forth, but he would sit next to me, and he'd pass them back the other way, so I never got high. I never used or got low. So when we had gotten to the first camp out after hiking like a mile and a half with Tara on my back and my backpack on my back and her with the flashlight saying hello to everyone who we passed, hi brother, hi sister, because that's what they were calling each other, she went into her first tent and she's like, "I like it here, Mommy," because Michael Bear, who had guided me clean, I could say his name because he's no longer with us, had put her stuffed animals and my pillow and a sleeping bag in there, and you know, we found a way to do what we had done without smoking pot, without Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill wine, without the partying and all that stuff, because I used to think partying was cool, and now I knew it wasn't. So now we start, a couple of years later, going to NA campouts. And one summer, my sister came in from Hong Kong with my niece and my nephew. And my niece, Tara was born on my niece's two-year birthday. So my first two grandchildren in our family had the same same birthday. And they got super close. And so this was already 1994. And so Tara was 6 and Erin was 8. And Erin said, Aunt Susan, I want to go camping with you. So I'm like, okay, when you come in next summer, I'll take you camping. But it was only a tight time frame of when they could come because of other plans my sister had. So I had to find a camp out in this one particular weekend, the beginning of July. And I started calling everyone I knew on the East Coast, and the New York region, the New Jersey region, the Connecticut region, the Massachusetts region, everywhere, Maryland, and nobody knew of a camp out. And one day, a grand sponsee of mine called me and said she'd been at a meeting in Long Island, and some guy named Barry, oh my God, 5 minutes, had told them about a Narcotics Anonymous camp out called the Happy Campers Group of Narcotics Anonymous. It was out in the middle of nowhere, and when I called and found out, there were no facilities, no bathroom, nothing. So when Erin came in and she got off the plane, I said, she goes, "Aunt Susan, when are we going camping?" I'm like, you know, I said, "You're not going to want to go. There's no bathroom." She goes, "Aunt Susan, the public toilets in Hong Kong are holes in the ground. I will be fine." So we started our camping adventures. It was amazing. I started inviting all my sponsees to go camping one year. Bobby would buy me another tent and an air mattress and a sleeping bag, and then I'd bring someone along and I'd say, "Do you like it?" They said, "I loved it. You want to buy the tent?" Sold it to them for the sale price, bought another one. One year there were like 10 cars full of women going to Narcotics Anonymous camp out in Connecticut. The miracles that have happened in my recovery, I can't even express. I got married in recovery. We all wound up with the same last name. My parents, who had been like so skeptical of me, they became my best friend. I became their caregivers. My father prepared us for his eventual passing when he was like 90 years old. He said, "You know, I don't have long to go. I know this, but I want you to promise you'll take care of Mom when I'm gone." Broke my heart. I cried. He was ready. I wasn't. He had the same conversation with Bobby. At this point, my parents adored Bobby. The first time my mother met him, my father offered him a drink. He had a second. My mother said, "If you're a drinker, leave now." But at this point, they adored him. And my father, who had been a truck driver all his life, had always had to tell me how to go somewhere. If I'd been to your house 30 times but was leaving that day, he would tell me the best routes. Before GPS, before, you know, Waze and Google Maps and all. So my father passed. in my mom's arms. My sister flew in for the funeral. And my sister and her family stayed at my parents' apartment. And they were going to take the limousine to the funeral service. I think it was in New Jersey. And we were going from the Bronx with, you know, Tara and her best friend and me and Bobby. And we get on the Cross Bronx Expressway. And a hearse pulls up right in front of us. And we're following this hearse to the funeral. And I said, my daddy's in that hearse. He was. My father led us to his funeral. I believe this. I believe in guardian angels. I believe in God incidences. I believe that nothing happens, everything happens for a reason. I was able, Bobby was the main caregiver for my mother. She lasted 8 years after my dad, which we never expected. We thought that she'd be gone within months. They were together like 50 years. So many amazing things. And I want to just read this, because to me, the attraction of Narcotics Anonymous for me, besides the love and the unconditional love, was the hugs. And I know our other fellowship, which we're based on, which I am so grateful for, they do things differently. But I just wanted to share this with you guys. So the first one is, we need 4 hugs a day for survival. Right, James? We need 8 hugs a day for maintenance. We need 12 hugs a day for growth. The other one is, hugging is healthy. It helps the body's immune system. It keeps you healthier. It cures depression. It reduces stress. It induces sleep. It's invigorating. It's rejuvenating. It has no unpleasant side effects. And hugging is nothing less than a miracle drug. Hugging is all natural. It is organic, naturally sweet. No pesticides, no preservatives, no artificial ingredients. And hugging is nothing less than a miracle drug. Hugging is all natural. Is organic. I read this already. I'm sorry. And is 100% wholesome. Hugging is practically perfect. There are no movable parts, no batteries to wear out, no periodic checkups, low energy consumption, high energy yield, inflation-proof, non-fattening, no monthly payments, no insurance requirements, theft-proof, non-taxable, non-polluting, and of course, fully returnable. And the theme of this convention, which is the joy is in the journey, that's how I try to live my life. I can obsess on a cup of coffee, but I try to remember. And this is what I'd like to end with. It's good to have an end to journey toward, but it is a journey that matters in the end. Thank you, guys.
All right, I'd like to thank Susan for a great meeting. As a reminder, the entertainment is free for this event. It's included with your registration. Saturday night, tonight, we have a comedy show in the Fitzgerald Ballroom, which starts at 10 p.m. tonight. Don't forget to visit merchandise, hospitality, and grab a cup of coffee from the coffee station. Can we please close this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer?